Vivian Gornick is a New Yorker, a veteran journalist, feminist, critic, teacher, and best-selling author. This hour, I'll talk with her about her life, her work, and her latest memoir. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Vivian Gornick grew up in the Bronx in the 30s and 40s. She was a reporter for the Village Voice in the 70s, became an influential essayist, feminist, and author of many books. Her latest memoir focuses on the evolution of friendship and identity. It's called The Odd Woman and the City. She's a distinguished visiting professor in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa, and I will talk with her this hour. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Vivian Gornick grew up in the Bronx in the 1930s and 40s. She was a reporter for the Village Voice in the 70s, became an influential essayist, feminist, and author of many books. Her latest memoir focuses on the evolution of friendship and identity. It's called The Odd Woman and the City, and it will be released this spring. She's a distinguished visiting professor in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa, and she'll be reading tonight at 7 p.m. in Iowa City at the Biology Building East, the Kohlroos Auditorium, Room 101, that is open to the public this evening, and she's here in the studio with us today. Hello, Vivian.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And your latest memoir is kind of a study of friendship over time. Mm-hmm. What was it that prompted you to write about friendship in this way?
let's see. How do I begin? There's a character in the book called Leonard. Leonard is a pseudonym for a very, very, very close friend of mine, a gay man who I met in gay and feminist politics 30 years ago. And we became fast friends, and our lives began to seem paradigmatic to me. You know, I'm the odd woman. He's gay. I live alone. He lives alone. 50% of all New York City households are single-person households. So we have grown in size and significance. People like us, who 50 years ago would never have been unmarried, no matter what. We would have been married, had children, stayed married, etc. So we are a generation that began to seem significant to me, and I wanted to use our friendship as a means of speaking more broadly about the changes that we've lived through in these last 40, at least 40 years. That was the beginning of my desire to write a memoir that would be based on this friendship. And it was also because the fact is, my friend Leonard, he's alone because he's gay. But 50 years ago, he probably would have gotten married, you know, even though, as you know, as we all know, thousands of people lived that kind of hidden life. And I certainly would have been, I mean, I was married twice and divorced, but the second time I probably would have stuck around if it wasn't for feminism, if it wasn't for all these immense changes in society and in the way in which we see ourselves, we would have been living those lives. But we're not living those lives. So I wanted to use us to describe the lives that are being used. But I couldn't find my way into a narrative story. All I had was the situation.
Now, you use the term odd woman. That's part of your title. But also, you just used it again. And you equate, in a way, your situation as an odd woman with your friend's situation as a gay man. And I'm
yes.
sure some people will think, what?
Well, then you got to read the book,
right,
and then you'll know. Yeah.
Define what you mean when you say odd
okay.
woman.
Actually, it comes from a literary reference. There's a very famous 19th century novel called The Odd Women by George Gissing. George Gissing's novel is one of the great feminist novels of the 19th century. And what he means by odd women is women like me, like us, like feminists who could not make their peace with the world as it is, who are not homosexual and who are not happy to become conventional heterosexual women. And these women whom he describes in this novel are pitch perfect, my generation. Here we were 100 years later, talking and feeling and acting just like the women in that novel. One of the great things about that novel is that he really puts these women through their paces, and you see them stumbling and fumbling their way through to figure out who they are and where they are and why they are. And we experience exactly the same thing. So I call myself the odd woman. It's a kind of a joke, but, you know, semi a joke. And suddenly I felt like it just fit me, because what the book ended up being was a deeper search in my sense of it, of the word. And I discovered that what allowed almost all of us to live the lives we live is the city. These are not lives that can be lived easily in rural America.
And
because
why?
You need company.
You need company. So that,
yeah, and if you don't have a family, you need friends. And you need all kinds of friends. And you need all kinds of experience that doesn't depend upon the particular shape of the family. That's really it, essentially. And so what I did was write a book which showed how people like me and Leonard use New York City. It could be anywhere, but it's our city and it's my city. So I began to understand how much I have used the city over the years and how many people like me have used it. I don't know if you've read the whole book. Then there's a section in it that is derived from the books of Isabel Bolton, a really, well, many, as I've grown up, I'm stuttering here, an extraordinarily wonderful independent woman in a time when independence was really difficult, you know, almost at the turn of the century, of the 20th century. As I've grown up and lived so much of my life in Greenwich Village, it was only now that I'm this old that I came to understand how many women like myself have lived in the village during my lifetime and whom I sort of knew en passant. Writers like Marguerite Young, Isabel Bolton, Juna Barnes, all kinds of really classy, brooding, independent, difficult, miserable women of talent and great independence. And it isn't that they chose the independence. It's that simply, as I feel about myself, I said no to this and I said yes to that and no to this and yes to that, and here I am.
Well, you write about, with your friendships, you write about how you fill the needs that you have in your life, your needs for socialization.
Right.
But by picking and choosing who you spend your time with and how much time you spend with them. And that's one of the things that you point out about this relationship with Leonard. You are very close friends, and you see each other about once a week.
Right.
And once a week is just the right amount.
Right.
And twice a week would probably be too much.
Right. There's one thing about living alone, about living our lives, about living without husbands and wives and children. You really get to think about what you actually experience in the company of another human being. You really get to think about it. It's, you know, when you live a married life, it goes unreviewed for weeks, months, years at a time, you know, especially.
It's habit, and you take it for granted.
You become habituated. When you're not alone, as thousands and thousands of people in New York City, for instance, are not, as I describe, the downside is you become extremely attuned to every little bit of psychological discomfort, and you're allowed to indulge it. Which is good and bad. You learn from it and you suffer from it. But yes, what Leonard and I learned was that, yeah, seeing each other more. We once shared a house for 6 weeks in the summer out at the beach. And And we didn't talk again for about 6 months after that. We got on each other's nerves so much. In other words, seeing him once a week for 6 or 7 hours, a long walk, dinner, a movie, was just perfect. A little bit more, and everything that irritated us and each other irritated us.
Right.
More than irritated.
And you describe you have similar personalities in many ways. So in some ways, do you think that it's the similarity that makes it difficult to be together so much, that you see in him the things that bother you about yourself,
yeah,
or vice versa?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's the downside. Yeah. Yeah, I do think that. It takes a lot of living to encounter another human being about whom nothing irritates you.
It's hard to imagine that human being.
It is hard,
right?
Yeah. And nobody should actually be looking for it. Nobody should require it or want it. But our situation allows for that particular experience.
Right. Now, it's interesting in thinking about your relationship with Leonard, but also your relationships with all these other people that you spend time with, that you seek out, because you need human interaction.
Absolutely.
You think a lot about how friendship and interaction with people feeds us. I mean, you become very intentional about that.
Yes.
And it's something that a lot of us, of course, as you've mentioned, when we are living in a family unit, we take that for granted. But is that something you meditate on? Do you think about, I'm feeling this way,
No, but the reason I have a book is just because I've been thinking and feeling these things for 30 years. I tapped into years and years of note-taking with notes that you put down in the way you would put down a diary entry. You know, not that you brood on it, but, you know, diary entries are full of, today, you know, this is how I felt. This is what happened. Then you look at it 20 years later, if you've still got it, and you think, oh, my God. But I'm going to use it.
Right. And it gives you perspective. You can understand it in a way that you couldn't understand it at the time.
Precisely. Precisely. If ever a memoir is the result of reflecting upon experience that's been tracked over many years, this is it. This little book. I look at it. This little book. This is what you've got to show for all these years.
It's a slim volume, but it's rich inside. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Vivian Gornick. We're talking right now about her latest memoir. It's called The Odd Woman and the City. She's written many books. She's also an essayist, well-known. Her work has been published all over the place. She also has been a journalist for many years. She is a feminist, and she is a distinguished visiting professor in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. She'll be reading tonight from her latest work at 7 p.m. in Iowa City in the Biology Building East, the Kohlrose Auditorium, that is open to the public this evening. We'll take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Vivian Gornick. She's a journalist, a teacher, an essayist, an author. Her latest memoir is called The Odd Woman and the City. It will be published this spring, and she's giving a reading tonight in Iowa City. And before the break, we were talking a lot about how this book is about friendship and your perspective, your thoughts on friendship over the years. And I want to talk about, you also write a lot about identity and how you think about yourself has shaped your life and put you in this situation where you are a woman living alone in New York City and seeking out friends in the way that you do. Let's go back to the 1970s when you became a feminist and you were involved in the feminist movement. And of course, you were a journalist, so you were reporting on the feminist movement, but also writing about it from your perspective. And you were working for the Village Voice, so you were allowed to have a perspective.
Oh, absolutely. It was all perspective.
Right?
It were no facts. It was just the truth. Right?
So as the feminist movement took hold, that changed the identity of so many women in this country. I mean, before that, whether you liked it or not, you knew for the most part, what you were going to do right. with your life. So do you think that that change really sparked a search in a lot of women for their identity, which they wouldn't have had to look for before?
Oh, absolutely. 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 All of these, the liberationist movements of the 1970s, and that includes blacks and gays. I mean, even though the blacks classically is the civil rights movement, in fact, it's a liberationist movement also, but certainly gays and women. And, you know, how to explain why it happened at that moment, there's no explanation. A concatenation of factors comes together. There's no way to know why, but all of a sudden, thousands of people are sparked to think something that they never thought before. And that's what happened to us. And I was one of those women in the 70s who suddenly came to understand the expectation that I would become a wife and a mother was fundamental without my realizing it. Because I was like many other girls, rebellious girl, romantic, thinking I'm going to change the world. But it had no legs at all. And in fact, I was married twice. Each of my husbands wanted more for me than I wanted for myself. And with each one, I said, I'm a writer. And each one said, great, sweetheart, sit down and write. And I couldn't, and I didn't. And it wasn't them. It was what I already was. And it was only feminism that made me see that I had grown up to be a person who could not take work seriously. Hmm. Now, for other women, it became, I am sexually in exile. I don't know who the hell I am sexually. But we all split, according to temperament, these concerns, work and sex. But what they represented was indeed identity. Who am I? Why am I as I am? What is it that I want? What is my life? The whole question of being able to think about a life that you might want to pursue was something that had been totally absent from our existence. Why and how this comes back every 50 years for the last 200 years, I can't explain. All I know is that that is what happened. And I was one of those women who was suddenly on fire with the excitement of thinking then past it and thinking about the whole history of women as second-class citizens. For many of us, it was an existential quest to understand, and it gave us large perspectives. I've just written recently, looking at new books, new feminist books, thinking about what a visionary generation we were. And this history, the visionary generation that comes every 50 years or so for the last 200 years since the French Revolution, more now, every 50 years or so, up sweeps this question again. And you have exactly the same thing all over again, a visionary generation that is followed by a very practical, struggle for one issue or another that represents what we're all, what we all feel our lives are about. In the 19th century, it was the vote. And in my generation, it was abortion rights. It became a single issue struggle over women's rights. But we, my generation, had very large visions of what it was all about. And we saw it in existential terms, the need for one part of the body politic to oppress another part of the body politic. And that we had been raised for centuries to believe we were nothing more than, as Simone de Beauvoir put it, the other, as if we were not the central actors in our own lives. We men were in their lives and in our lives.
Right.
And we did not have agency. And you can put it 15 different ways. And to put it 15 different ways means a culture begins to change. And that's exactly what happened. I am sure I would have been the most miserable wife and mother imaginable. I'm sure of it. I don't have a maternal bone in my body, as my students will tell you. They can all tell you. So I would have been absolutely miserable, and I've lived long enough to not be miserable. I mean, in other words, to feel that there was a great deal of deliberation in the life that I've lived.
You know, now I am a woman who owes an incredible debt to the women of the 1970s.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
All professional women
are. Yes, absolutely.
You know, and I grew up, I was born in 1975, so I grew up with this mantra of you can be anything that you want to be.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't just for women. It was also for men. We all were told we can be anything that we want to be.
That's right.
Which is a very exciting prospect. It's also kind of daunting. You know, I'm one of the lucky ones. I figured out what I wanted to be, and I feel very fortunate. But
it is daunting.
Do you feel like in some ways it set an entire generation adrift of, wait, I have to find myself. I have to figure out what I want to be. World is
right.
Is at my disposal, but I just have to figure out what I want and how to take advantage of it.
All we've learned is that this is how millions of men have felt all these years. When a man goes to war, you think he's quote unquote a brave hero? Ridiculous. He's a terrified human being. When a woman goes to war, she says, this is what they've been experiencing for generations. Do men know who they are? Have they found themselves? Do most men work at expressive work? Do they feel in control? Do they feel pulled around by their families? When we started.
But, you know, they were also, before the feminist movement, men were also in a similar box because they also knew that they would get married and they would have children and they had to provide for their
driven.
Family.
And then be driven. Yeah. Right. I mean, most men have lived their lives telling everybody under the sun, oh, God, if it wasn't for the family, or my whole life means the family. People say that when they don't know who the hell they are. I mean, nobody's life should be the family. What does that mean? Everyone in the world should have a family. Everyone in the world should have domestic tranquility and a place in the world enterprise. So, I mean, I've known so many men over my years who have been grateful for the excuse of the family to work at things that they did not want to work at, did not love, which did not nourish them in any way. Or conversely, was their big excuse for working, you know, 18 hours a day and never knowing how to be with their families. This is the human condition. The question of identity, no, we didn't set women adrift. We set them no more adrift than men have ever been. And that, in the end, should be a good thing. It should make us comrades. Not yet. Not yet.
Well, you've seen so many waves come and go with the feminist movement. And right now, we are experiencing this moment where people who are in the public eye seem to be enjoying stating their feminism. They want, I don't know, that's saying, yes, I'm a feminist, whether you're a woman or a man, publicly seems to be something right now that is very in vogue. Well, among movie stars, et cetera.
Oh, them.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yes. Yes.
So when you see that happening, how do you feel about
that? I feel good. It's a lot of it's full. I didn't watch the Oscars, but I saw a clip from them, and I saw Patricia Arquette, the Patricia Arquette speech, and I saw all these women led by Meryl Streep leap up in the audience. I just saw this clip, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is it? I'm happy. I'm happy that whatever, in whatever form it's happening, I'm always happy to see it. In fact, it's not fashionable now to be called a feminist. And there it is. What's more interesting is there is what's called a third wave made up of young women. But these young women, oddly enough, they call themselves feminists, but they are of two minds about struggling for women's rights. They're involved with poverty. They're involved with immigration. They're involved with good causes, human rights. A lot of them go out into the world and as what they think of it, well, they're independent women. They think of themselves as independent women. And they do in the world. And I'm happy to see that. But the visionary quality of the time when you were really proud to be a feminist because you knew what that meant, that you were really struggling for equality for women across the board in every single sphere of life when you wanted to see girls born into the world on an equal playing field. In other words, as Freud said, just as happy to be as miserable as men. I mean, just to be not to suffer for gender over sex, not to suffer any extra deprivation because of your sex. That's all that we wanted, and that's all that I still want, just to see that equality. But that's not what feminists are doing today. They're really not. I mean, they're spunky, incredibly spunky young women, and I love them all. And I'm happy that they're doing whatever they're doing. But I want to see endless consciousness about women's rights. And I guess I'll just die wanting that. Because equality is far from won. You've been following this Silicon Valley suit. Have you been following this? This woman is suing a huge techie company out in Silicon Valley. She's a vice president, I think, fired, and is accusing them of sexual bias. And out of the woodwork have come like a dozen women to testify to the same thing. It's classy stuff. It's women who want to be at the top in the tech world. So there are no women at the top in the tech world. And I don't really care about being at the top in the tech world, but I do care about parity. I care about those who do wish to be there being allowed in. And there are still thousands of places and thousands of situations in which there is no in. That's all. Listen to me ranting. Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about, I mean, when you look at the world of education, for example, there is a little bit of a backlash going on. People who say that we've focused so much on girls in education that now boys are falling behind in education.
And they've been falling behind for a long time. Yeah.
When you look at the world of education, though, I don't know. From my perspective, things look pretty good. Do you have a sense of accomplishment?
Oh, absolutely.
We've done that. We've done it.
We've done a lot, a huge amount of it. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it. You know, when I was a girl, it was like less than 1% of all faculties were women. When I started teaching in the late 60s, early 70s, and I wasn't serious about teaching. I was struggling to become a writer, but I was trying to make a living now and then for teaching. And I got a job as an assistant, something or other, an instructor in an English department in a university near New York City. And the chairman of the department didn't hesitate to say to me, "Well, you know, women never get tenure here." I said, "Oh, of course not." I mean, we look back on those utterly innocent, utterly conventional exchanges, and it seems like a dinosaur age. Of course, I think a huge amount has been done. And isn't it odd that as women progress, men regress? What does that tell us about the competitiveness of our world? What does that tell us about the need for men to always have felt themselves in a sufficiently superior position that they could brave the world?
When we have equality in education, it's very, very easy for boys and girls to take that equality for granted. Do you feel like that has damaged the feminist cause, that girls grow up thinking, Of course, I'm entitled to this. This is how life should be.
Not only am I entitled to it, but the whole thing is over. The revolution has been won. people like me sound like dinosaurs to a 25-year-old woman or a 30-year-old woman. If you talk about what hasn't been done, what hasn't been accomplished, but it's been like that forever. And that huge push for women's rights, I don't think it will come again in my lifetime. But it will come. It will come. This is what you call socialization. First comes this huge social rebellion, which is the visionary years, and then comes a long slog. And that's social progress. That's how it changes. But no other way. It's just slow.
When you look at the subject globally, the picture is so very different.
Talk about daunting.
Right. And sometimes I wonder how the culture in the United States and of course, in Western Europe and in the UK, yeah, and how it can be so incredibly different for women in these countries than it is in so much of the rest of the world.
Well, women's rights depends for its very life on a completely secular society. Even though we're now being called religious, this is not a religious country. This is a secular democracy. And it's only in secular democracies that women's rights, any kind of liberationist struggles, have any, you know, real teeth. The rest of the world is dominated by religious cultures and peasant cultures. If there's no education and a world is dominated by religious injunctions to observe a kind of a great chain of being, you know, God, man, woman, it's hopeless.
We're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Vivian Gornick. She is a journalist, an essayist, a best-selling author. Her most recent memoir is called The Odd Woman and the City. It will be released this spring. She will be giving people a preview tonight at 7 p.m. in Iowa City at the Biology Building East, Kolros Auditorium, room 101. And that is open to the public. We will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I have Vivian Gornick in the studio with me today. She is a journalist, a teacher, a feminist, an author of many books. She grew up in the Bronx in the 30s and 40s. She's lived in New York her entire life, except for semesters at universities around the country. And you write about that in your book. And I'm curious why you do it, because it feels like it's difficult for you to leave New York City and to leave your friends. That seems like a real challenge,
yeah,
for you.
Well, I do it to make a living.
Well, yes.
We can just dispense with that very quickly. No, I teach in order to make a living. I don't teach as a vocation. And so I've been forced to go since I'm a writer and I don't have higher degrees, or even if I had them. Since I'm a writer, usually what we do is write and teach. Teach what we do. So that's why I do not enjoy living outside of New York. And at this point in my life, I've traveled quite a lot, and I've lived in a lot of other places. I lived in the Middle East for a year. I've lived in California for a couple of years. I lived in New Mexico for a year. So, you know, I'm old enough to have done all that, and New York just kept drawing me back and back and back. So it's my temperament. I need the street. I need human density. I need everything that I've described in The Odd Woman and the City, actually, in which I show what connecting with the anonymous crowd means for me, for people like me. I really need concrete beneath my feet, that concrete.
Well, I can't think of it. I love living in Iowa, and I've chosen to live in Iowa.
Right.
But I can't imagine how difficult it must be for you to come alone to Iowa City in January and, you know, and build sort of a mini life.
Yes.
What an incredible challenge that must be.
It's not that terrible. We all speak the language. I don't have to deal.
Right.
I can manage to get bread and milk. And which way is it to the shoe store without too much difficulty? It's been somewhat solitary, actually, living here. But the apartment that I'm occupying is very bright and light, and I can read, write, watch television, sleep with comfort. And indeed, it's been an oddly solitary life, much more than I have experienced in many, many years. But it's okay. But I teach. I have students. I have colleagues. But indeed, the town has felt dreary for these last few months.
Right. Well, the sunshine is here now. That'll help.
Yes, and that's a great pleasure. There is one thing in New York City, no matter what the weather is, there is no weather, really. No matter what the weather is, you go tramping through your life. And the absence of interesting things to look at in Iowa City is bigger than anything else for me.
You certainly feel the weather.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. People keep telling me it's beautiful here in the spring and summer, and I'm sure I can imagine that it will be thickly green, and that is its own glory. But, you know, the thing about small cities and towns is, the whole difference between a big city and a small city is the absence of variety that meets the eye, architecturally, humanly, store windows, screeching brakes, all kinds of things are happening that you don't realize how much it influences your life until you're deprived of it.
Right.
It's sensory deprivation is what it is.
I was fascinated by one of the things that you wrote about in your book. And I recently passed a milestone birthday. And so I guess I've been thinking about, you know, evolution and growing up and growing older and all of that. And so you wrote about when you were 60 years old, you experienced a real change in the way that you thought. And maybe you can describe this for us a little bit. I mean, start with telling us about the daydreaming that you have done or had done up to that point your entire life and what happened.
Yes. What I wrote about in The Odd Woman in the City was indeed when I was turning 60, which is now already in the past, when I was turning 60, I walked every single day for years and years and years, took long walks. When I was turning 60, I was teaching in Arizona and walking along a country road every day. And one day during that time, I started daydreaming, as I always did. Talk about something that you do on automatic without thinking about. It never occurred to me that I was daydreaming as I walked. Never. I was just walking and not thinking, but
letting your mind do whatever it wanted to do.
Letting my mind wander, right. Yeah. Right. And it wandered to daydreams. Tomorrow I will lose weight. Tomorrow I'll become the woman I've never become. Tomorrow I'll write a book that will last for 1,000 years. Tomorrow I'll meet the man of my dreams. It was always tomorrow. And I'd spin off these scenarios in my head. That day, suddenly, the picture in my head went static, like a television screen that suddenly got covered with snow. And I had a bad taste in my mouth. The two together were a shock. I couldn't figure out what the hell had happened. It was literally as if there was a television movie going on in my head, and it just suddenly stopped. The next day, the same thing happened again, and it happened two or three times more. It just kept happening.
Did you worry that something physically was
going
wrong?
Absolutely. I thought I was having a brain tumor. Yeah. I thought I was ill. And suddenly I realized that something in me was not allowing the daydreaming. And I began to think about how much of my life I had spent in that way, hours every day, thinking about the past or the future, but not being there in the present. It literally was, if I've ever had an out-of-body experience and I'm the least physical person you're ever going to meet, that was it. It was. I forgot what they call those experiences that are the physical equation of an emotional event. Of course, there's a name for it, but I've lost it right this minute. But that's what that is exactly what happened. And from that time on, I began to make really very conscious efforts to be ultra present.
In the moment.
In the moment. To be living in the moment, by which I don't mean adopting a recklessness. On the contrary, it was the determination to die a more conscious human being and that I set more store by that.
So can you give me an example of how that changed your thought process?
Well, my thought process, it makes me observe more clearly. It makes me pay attention.
And is that a permanent change? I mean, that was...
Yes, it has been.
number of years ago.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, as the years go on, you know, it gets worse. If you if I were to retreat into daydreaming now, I'd be a lunatic. I wouldn't be here doing what I have to do right this second. I'd be letting age steal my life.
Well, and you've watched people let that happen to them.
Thousands. I never think about age. I never think about aging. I never think about death. I never think about all these juicy subjects that everybody I know does. I mean, I'm blessed in that way. I mean, what for? It's so pointless and it's so banal.
Do you feel like that's a conscious decision? Because you
no.
No, really. That's interesting.
It's a temperamental one.
But you write about you and Leonard, your friend.
Yeah.
This is to go back to the beginning of the hour, this friendship that is at the base of your new memoir. And you write about how both of you have this ability to spot the cloud in any silver lining.
Right. I've stopped.
Okay. Really?
He hasn't, but I have.
You have stopped?
Absolutely.
And was that also a conscious decision?
That is... No, I don't think any of it is. I do really believe these have been psychological developments. I wouldn't say progress, but I would say a development. More and more boring to just see the negative.
Interesting.
Yeah, it really did.
Has that affected your friendship?
Are you listening? No,
he's
this is just going
not.
Out in Iowa.
Right.
Well, to some degree. But we give each other a lot of leeway now. We cut each other a lot of slack. But
well,
yes.
That's important in any long-lasting friendship.
Yes, it is. And we do that.
I want to talk a little bit about your students. You've always been a lover of literature as well as a journalist and a writer. When you look, and not just your students, but when you look at the literary scene today.
Yeah. Go on.
A derisive
Let's
snort.
Let's pass over that.
All right.
Yeah.
So what do you see? What do you see in this moment in literature?
In literature? Mm-hmm. Oh, in literature. In literature, it is as in everything else. I do not believe it is a prosperous time for the arts. And people will tell you this in every single one of the arts, that what people feel, certainly people in my generation, is that while there's a huge amount of technical skill that has developed, craft, God help us, I'm so sick of craft. Yes, while there's a huge amount of that in every one of the arts, there is not a huge amount either of imagination or vision or of the kind that people feel acutely, which they should feel when they encounter the arts.
Why do you think that is?
why is that? How to account for the changes in the world? I can't account for it. You know, I could sound off like any other jerk in the world and, you know, tell you philosophically. It's a whole concatenation of factors from the Second World War on. The world has changed for the last 50 years in the last 50 years of the 20th century, one would have to say, first of all, a peculiar amount of politics has replaced the arts in an odd way. This massive drive towards universal consciousness everywhere in the world, modernism coming to an end at the same time, modernism coming to a real end. At the same time, the development of modernism came from a shattered sense of the world, which was exciting for 50 years at least, from the First World War on. When modernism ran its course, there's nothing really to replace it. What replaced it was this massive amount of political testimony, starting with the Holocaust. I mean, these are my, you know, off the top of my head notions of how things came about, but how to actually explain why there is an absence of that kind of soul, you'd have to say, of, you know, deep feeling in the world now that creates great art is really hard to say.
I've wondered in reading your thoughts on that, I've wondered, we have these opportunities now that we've never had before to pursue careers in the arts from the get-go.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I almost wonder if that's part of a shift where we have young people who want to be artists, who train to be artists, who learn the craft and learn the skills, as opposed to people who live but have to be artists.
Exactly. Well, they were always a small number of that. There were always only a small number of serious students, serious artists, serious readers, serious everything. They've been overwhelmed by participatory democracy. You've never, ever before in the history of the world had so many people into higher education and so much less meaning to that. People now need a college degree that's the equivalent of a high school degree of 50 years ago. And they don't need these degrees in order to do the job. They need them in order to get the job. And that is what university life has become. So there's this, the same small good number of talented, serious people is there, surrounded by swarms and swarms and swarms of people who are calling themselves students, but they're not students, who are calling themselves writers who are not writers, artists who are not writers, who are not artists. It's the meaning of universal democracy. It's it's the trade-off that there's less and less room. You know, we don't have high culture anymore. We have pop culture. We know all these things. We thought that that would be a universal good, those of us who were fighting for it 40 years ago. But it's a very mixed bag. There will still be, I don't know, you know, none of us know what forms of art will dominate in the next years. I work in these MFA programs, and I'm here working in one of these MFA programs. And these programs are now, you know, they're ubiquitous. There's 300 of them, and there's like, you know, 60, 90 people in each of them. It's not a question of people being writers or not being writers. What these programs are really meant for is to teach people how to read their own work, develop judgment about writing. That's a good thing. But it has really more to do with actually trying to produce an educated reader than it has to do with producing writers. And not calling it as it is not a good thing. It's not good to see what writing programs can do and cannot do. And believe me, I know people in music and in visual arts who all have the same thing to say. It's a wonderful thing to culturally educate people to learn how to read a piece of writing. That's a wonderful thing. What's oppressive is all this business about being creative artists. I work in programs that are called creative nonfiction. I don't know what those words mean. I've never known, and most of us don't. The word creative has just been destroyed, desiccated. It should close its doors. There are a number of words: amazing, awesome, brilliant, creative. They should be just put to sleep.
We could do another hour
on that. But it's a good thing. The programs are a good thing in the sense that they are acculturation.
Well, Vivian,
have I just destroyed myself?
No, I don't think so. But thank you so much for talking with me today.
Is this going to sound bad for the MFA program?
No, you're wonderful. All right, Vivian Gornick is the author most recently of a book. Actually, it hasn't yet been published, The Odd Woman and the City. It's a memoir. And she'll be reading tonight in Iowa City at 7 p.m. in the Biology Building East. It is open to the public. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, it's Wildlife Day with Jim Pease. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.